Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Blizzard's Greatest Games podcast, recorded at Outset Studios in beautiful South Wimbledon. Joining myself, Marcus Speller and Jonathan Wilson, today is John Bruin, freelance sports writer for The Guardian, among others. John, lovely to have you with us.
Lovely to be here, Marcus.
The game that you have chosen for us to feast upon today is the 2005 Champions League final in Istanbul. Liverpool 3, AC Milan 3. Of course, Liverpool won 3-2 on penalties. I shouldn't have to ask this, but I will. Why have you chosen this one?
Simple answer, really.
Is it because you're a massive Liverpool fan?
Well, despite not being a massive Liverpool fan, it's the best game I've ever been to. I've ever seen the greatest spectacle. And just one of those ridiculous nights where a game gets carried away with itself to the point where you just can't believe what you're seeing. Even though, as I'm sure we'll get onto, there was a certain inevitability after a certain point about what was going to go on. People talk a lot about emotion in football, but this was definitely one of those games which a night was carried by emotion, tension, and I wouldn't say a sense of destiny, but in one sense, disbelief about what was going on, actually from both teams, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Liverpool, they're a very special football club. And nights like this really kind of define that, don't they? This is the kind of, as you say, you talk about the emotion, you talk about the passion. And it's almost like that kind of spirit of Liverpool, past managers, past players, all that kind of stuff, all channeling into one thing that produces an absolutely outrageous result.
Well, certainly, in terms of European football, that has been the way that... I mean, I think it's fair to say no club quite has its own self-mythology like Liverpool, but in this case, there's no way you can mythologise about this game.
Because there's an interesting point there. I think often these self-mythologies, while it can be very damaging, where, you know, if it's a club that is sort of demanding to play a style of football that's out of keeping with their stature, West Ham, Everton, for instance,
Newcastle.
Well, I mean,
oh, we don't have to name them all.
but it can be a real positive. It can be self-fulfilling.
So, it's what Manchester United are trying to do.
Yeah, but but Liverpool's sort of belief in their capacity for the big nights when they always come back and they always get the late goal they need, based almost entirely on one game against Saint-Étienne in 1977, somehow it works.
Yeah.
And we've seen it this season, the comebacks, and I think it works two ways. One, part of it is Liverpool and the crowd, they know that tradition and so the sort of belief that we can get back, even though we need three goals or four goals, we can get back. And also the opposition start to feel it, kind of, hang on, maybe this lead isn't safe. And, that psychological tipping is one of the things that allows it to happen. The belief it can happen. Because it's believable, it becomes achievable.
Of course, absolutely. And,
on this night, I do think that the fans had quite a lot to do with what went on. I was in Istanbul. I was there for 3 or 4 days, as it turned out. And,
did you miss your flight home? Did you end the celebration?
Well, no, I just got there on a Monday morning. And I was much delayed getting back, but that was no fault of my own. I was on time.
Okay,
but, getting in and out of there was incredible. I mean, Jonathan will know this, I'm sure you do, Marcus, that when everyone descends, the gathering of the tribes at these types of events, Istanbul is very special because it's a European city, but only just because
half it isn't, right?
Yes, exactly.
In Asia, so.
And such an enormous city as
quite,
well.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing. Getting out to that stadium.
I think we should talk about that. The stadium itself.
is not in Istanbul, is, surely.
Yeah, it's a good 7, 8, 9 miles so outside Istanbul.
Which continent is the stadium in then?
I don't know, actually.
Is it, yeah, I have a feeling it might be Europe, but...
It's the same side of the Bosphorus as the airport, yes. So I think it must be Europe.
Yeah, but I mean, I would describe it, with no disrespect to the environs of of Istanbul, but the scene when people... when okay, what happened was in the battle bus I travelled up there with... when everyone realised that they weren't going to get near to the stadium, everyone peeled out of these buses and taxis and whatever else and walked down to a stadium in which the lights were blaring out. Now, Close Encounters of the Third Kind is that famous scene. It was just incredible.
Yeah, I mean...
Through wasteland and...
I arrived on the day of the game, starting naively, and I landed and I kind of thought, oh, maybe I should go to my hotel and check in. And then, yeah, I'd heard a few whispers of kind of, it's not that easy to get there. And I sort of had 7 hours for kickoff. I thought, I'll go straight to the stadium, just to be on the safe side. Rang the hotel, said, don't worry, I will be there. And I was in the queue for taxis, quite a long queue. And there's these two Aussie Liverpool fans were in front of me. And we'll go into the stadium, we'll share a cab. And within about an hour and a half, we got to, you could see the stadium. Uh-huh. It was just over these sort of, they looked like allotments or something, over these sort of fields with kind of some mm-hmm. produce growing there. And, there was a policeman at the bottom of the road, and he was saying, you know, asking Liverpool or Milan. And yeah, if you said Liverpool, he pointed mm-hmm. to his left. And so we set off.
Bridal
and group. I'm assuming like we're 20, 30 minutes away because I can see the thing.
Yeah.
But we got this massive loop into the mountains. And when we turn the corner in this taxi, we join a queue, and the queue's not moving. And in this sort of moonscape, it's just this dry, dusty.
Yeah.
And we crawl down this road. And there's these buses, and there's people obviously been drinking all day on these buses, getting off and urinating by the side of the road. It's like this sort of refugee train or something. And then, you know, sitting in this queue for like 5 hours. And eventually it gets to half an hour before kickoff. And I can see the stadium. And I think it's a couple of miles away. But I haven't got my accreditation or anything. So I just got out of the taxi and I paid him, obviously. And then I ran. So I get the accreditation centre. And thankfully I was late enough, there was no queues. Got my accreditation sorted, went straight into the ground, but I was dripping with sweat because it was a hot night, humid night. And I'd literally run 2 miles with my bag and sit down next to Paddy Barclay, the very well-known, mm-hmm. Much respected football journalist. And I'm soaking. And I get my laptop out, massive adrenaline rush, and the first thing I see is Paolo Maldini putting Milan ahead after 53 seconds or something.
A rare volley from...
A rare volley.
Yeah.
And so because I had this sort of hyper kind of sort of relief of being there, I sort of started typing. And so I think this is perfect. Yeah, Maldini was 36 and he turned 37 the following month. So, you know, Maldini capping this great career with his really good finish from an awkwardly bouncing free kick. And... Yeah, you know, I've sort of written 500 words within 10 minutes. But yeah, I can't think of a harder ground to get to.
But the whole thing, and that only adds to it for me, the whole thing about being in Istanbul, we've talked a tiny bit about the city and whatnot, the whole final, the White Plaza, is mythical almost.
Yeah, as we're finding out this season, you know, the European events are going to wider places. Yes. Baku could be of a similar legend, but I often think about that final that if Liverpool had not won it, I think we'd have heard a lot more about how the logistics of getting there and getting back. I remember travelling back from that game, you know, everybody absolutely euphoric after what happened, but you see Liverpool fans stood up on a bus. And they'd been on a bus, going back into Istanbul for 4 or 5 hours. We didn't get back into central Istanbul till 4 in the morning or something like that.
Yeah. I think it was well after that. Because don't forget that the game would have been kicking off at 10:45.
Yeah. And to contrast that, if I may, I went to the final in Rome in 2009,
yeah.
Barcelona. Yeah. You know, our flight was only a few hours after the game. So we managed to leave the stadium, get back to where the buses were parked, which were a little bit further away from the stadium, get to the airport, you know, we probably touched down at about 4 or 5 in the morning, whereas you've just got back to the city centre.
Yeah, well,
compared, I mean, Rome isn't the most organised of places at the best of times, but
it was
compared
definitely,
to that.
Definitely light by the time I got back to the hotel.
Yeah, I mean, that's remarkable.
I mean, you speak to Liverpool fans, there'll be several stories about how they went straight to the airport and not, a lot of people would have missed their flight
because of the
logistics of getting out there, where it almost got to the point, I'm told, where people just, if you're on a flight back to England, just get on this one. Mm. Almost like a standing room only on flights back. Absolutely chaotic.
Like London buses.
But you're right, that is part of the legend, the people who you know, travelled by land and got, you know, trains, and obviously it was all the issue in Bulgaria.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, this huge... When you win, that's great, this huge cavalcade across Europe.
Yeah.
And the hard, you know, the difficulty getting that adds to it, but that was not a...
Yeah, the feeling at half-time would have been probably a bit different. You know?
Well, at half-time... I mean, that's one of my overriding memories of the night is, you know, they're 3-0 down.
Should we talk about the first half?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So Maldini scores, they're 1-0 up, and Milan just look, as they were, a much, much better side.
Utterly dominant. I mean, when you said about...
Shevchenko had a goal, he ruled out for a very, very tight offside.
Offside, which would have made it 2-0, yes.
Yeah, and then Shevchenko lays on the second for Crespo. And, nice move, low cross. Crespo comes in at the back post, taps it in. Liverpool's defence absolutely all over the place. Jimmy Traore not having his best night.
No.
And then the third goal, right on the stroke of half-time, absolutely beautiful goal. Like Kaká, who's probably the best player on the pitch, certainly in the first half, this fantastic arced pass. Jamie Carragher desperately stretching to try and get there. Can't get there. Crespo runs on. First touch, little dink over Dudek. 3-0. And I've sort of written my piece and I thought 50 words to kind of just add in a bit of...
And you can put your feet up for the second half, probably.
Yeah. Shevchenko had 2 further goals in the second half, full stop. There we go.
Yeah,
all
exactly.
Done.
Well, for me, the first half, going all the way back to the Maldini goal, as you were writing, I believe, when you said you'd written about 500 words or something, was... Oh, well, that's, as you say, capping off a night. It's almost like a farewell kind of...
I mean, little did we know Maldini would be playing in the final again 2 years later.
Yeah, well, of course. But when the third one went in, it was bad enough, you think, I could get to half-time at 2-0, damage limitation. When the third one goes in just before the stroke of half-time, and the manner of which it goes in, to dink the ball like that, it was. They were so superior.
Yeah, I think Jonathan underplayed just how good a goal that was. Yeah. I mean, the finish by Crespo is
brilliant goal.
It's just I don't think. I mean, reading stuff, he couldn't believe how good a finish it was.
But the confidence,
yeah,
to do that. I mean, you look at the two starting lineups. It is almost is quite laughable, really. Now,
Liverpool lost Harry Kewell after 23 minutes.
Yeah,
to a muscular injury. So yeah, they'd had to rejig. As it turned out, Vladimir Smicic coming on did them a favour.
And Kewell had been a big risk. He'd been, I mean, over the couple of days before the game, that had been the talk that Benitez, who, as we know, likes to tinker with his team, that would be the risk that he would take. That was the word escaping from the dressing room. And I'm not sure it's one that anyone particularly agreed with that he should play. Unfortunately for Kewell, it's probably one of the defining moments of his career, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was a player who, of such great talent, he had a habit of getting injured and then being fit just in time for finals and then
breaking down or not,
it not really happening
final,
for him in
yeah.
the final. That first half, it was disaster upon disaster for Liverpool.
Mm. And as I say, going back to those starting lineups, yes, some of those players, as we were discussing beforehand, were perhaps past their best.
Not quite at their best, yes.
Yeah, well, some not quite at the best, and some sort of past.
But still, you look at that.
Kaká was. He was.
Pirlo, Gattuso, Seydorf, Kaká. I mean, that's a midfield.
they're certainly canny operators, as you would say. Shevchenko
and Crespo up front. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I was going to say that the legend of Pirlo wasn't quite as it was later. I think this is one of the games in which, you know, I would tell a story about him. I ended up sat with some execs from the company I used to work for, ESPN, and one of them's father was there. It wasn't a nepotism thing. He actually was working out there. Right. And he'd never been to a football game before. And this was the first football match he'd been to.
They're all like this.
Is it normally this hard to get to a football match?
And exactly. And this is he was 70 years old or so. And he turned to me and he said, "This Pirlo guy, does he know what he's doing?"
Really?
Yeah, just like he was a guy who was into the arts, into the ballet and stuff like that, and he couldn't believe how good he was. The fact that Pirlo would receive the ball and know where the ball was going next, and his movement, and just enthused about that to me throughout the game.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's quite fascinating. Well, So we get to half-time.
Yes.
And Jamie Carragher said, when looking back on the game once, he said, when he went off at half-time, he started going through his mind the biggest margins in
Yeah, that's what I spent my half-time doing, was going through what's the record win.
Exactly. And he
7-3
7-3 or 4-0 with Milan against Barcelona.
Yes,
94.
Of course. Yeah.
And Carragher was thinking, okay, what's... I don't want to be the worst.
Yeah.
Essentially. Can we... How do we... keep this damage limitation. Mm. And he said, if you'd have offered us, literally as they're walking off the pitch, if you'd have offered them the 3-0 loss there and it 0-0 in the second half, he said, we'd have bitten your hand off.
Yeah. And yet, the flip side of that, the Nobby had come from 2-0 down to win a European Cup final since Benfica in 62.
Absolutely. You know, and who would have thought that bringing on Didi Hamann would have had such an effect?
Well, that half-time is legendary as chaos.
Well, I was just going to say, my personal experience is, you know, heading to the... to use the facilities, which were not too wonderful, it has to be said. And the, how should I put this? The conspiracy theories that were flying around inside among the Liverpool fans, how UEFA have done us again and this, you know, this place, this is a disgrace and all this type of thing. And just like, this was it. And I also received a text message from a friend in Manchester. They just say they've humiliated themselves. This is brilliant. And, you know, funny enough, I didn't receive the text message till after the game. But it was, yeah, but because again, mobile signals and all the rest of it weren't particularly working that night. But just
the twinkle in your eye, John, suggests that you enjoy reminding yourself about that text message.
Well, I just think it's just one of those hostage to fortune things. It's just hilarious and he must have looked back on it. Some people have spoken about it since, but you know, a good friend of mine, I'll name him actually, Richard Stead, BBC employee. But the one thing is, though, that there were those Liverpool fans that were down and out and okay, you know, well, at least we were here and all this type of thing.
Sure, aren't you? Yeah.
But walking back in, as soon as the games began for the second half, the atmosphere started, the Liverpool fans got behind their team, and it became one of those famous European nights, but not at Anfield, this time in Istanbul.
But there is a little bit of a myth. I mean, the famous sort of very slow version of You Never Walk Alone, which is meant to have changed everything. Like maybe it did, but the fact is that Sami Hyypiä makes a brilliant challenge on Cafu to stop him, essentially a tap in to make it 4-0, and then he should have been sent off for Fallon Kaká. A really obvious professional foul.
Yes, and
but he gets away with, probably because the ref's thinking it's 3-0 already. You know, it's not going to matter. Why would I don't need to send him off.
And the other thing is that the Milan players didn't push for it in a way that you might expect. Yeah. Certainly, they would push for him to get sent off to see. It's one of those things where these days a 3-0 comeback is actually, you know, it's not that unrealistic. We've seen so many of them. But in those days, you probably thought, oh, we've done this.
But do you think this
And also,
match...
there's that code in Italian football that you don't humiliate the opposition. You might want to favour them later, so we'll hold it at 3-0. And the assumption is they know that they've beaten 3-0 and you both hold back. We should talk about half-time then, about tactical change.
Yeah.
So Steve Finnan is injured and he's not injured and he's injured again and eventually the Liverpool physio...
does not want to go off.
Doesn't want to go off. And he's gone into the showers and he's come back. And eventually Dave Galley, the Liverpool physio, says no, he can't last another 45. Off he goes. So they decide to change to a back three. Didi Hamann comes on. Amid this chaos, Rafa on his whiteboard, at some points has 10 players on the pitch, at some points he has 12. Uh-huh. It's complete chaos. But he eventually gets it, comes up with a system to stop the Milan surge with Hamann playing in front of the back three. And however chaotic the process of getting to that might have been, it did work. He found a way of stopping the momentum of the game.
It wasn't the rousing Hollywood speech that people might have thought.
Well,
I
mean, look, Rafa's a brilliant manager, and I've got a lot of time for him. I really like Rafa. I don't think he's a man who's going to give you a rousing speech.
No, of course
not. That's not what he's
good at. But the half-time in the Liverpool dressing room at half-time is not what one would have thought.
But Steven Gerrard is. Gave a sort of Churchillian speech about how he was a Liverpool lad and wanted, you know, I don't think that Benitez is an Alex Ferguson that could conjure that type of moment, but he found his way. They rode their luck a little bit, as Jonathan said. But you do have to wonder what was going on at half time in the other dressing room. Yeah. And that's always been one of the mysteries.
Well, the story is that you could hear them celebrating and kind of that sort of. I mean, it's so, an easy thing for people to say afterwards.
Yeah.
That, oh, you know, yeah, we heard them celebrate and we thought, all right, we've got to show them. I mean, you're 3-0 up and you absolutely hammered them. Why wouldn't you be pretty happy about it?
I mean, I pulled a quote actually from Pirlo's book. He said, we sat like a bunch of half-wits in the dressing room there at the Ataturk Stadium. We were bloodthirsty zombies faced with an unforeseen problem. The blood was ours, and they drunk every last drop. We couldn't speak. We couldn't move.
I mean, amazing, really, isn't it? And Pirlo, having read his book, I remember some of the quotes saying that he almost thought about quitting football after. He said that sort of 5 or 6 minutes, he said, it just doesn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense. So I suppose we should start with that Steven Gerrard goal after, 54 minutes?
I was going to say, Marcus, we haven't even mentioned Steven Gerrard yet. Yeah. I mean, because
we had a decent second half, didn't we?
Yeah.
But you're right. He was the man of the match in the end. But yet, has a man of the match ever had such a first half like that? Not just him.
It might be said of Steven Gerrard that there were games when this happened. Hmm. But he always possessed the fortitude to pull himself into games. Sometimes it didn't go quite so well. That's one of the sad facts about Gerrard, actually, is that this game, particularly that the second half that Jonathan speaks of and throughout the extra time, is one of the great performances. And it should define his career, yet it didn't end up doing so, really, in a strange way.
Scott Murray, who writes for The Guardian, has co-wrote a book with me on Liverpool. But he's got this theory about Gerrard that he's sort of like the modern embodiment of Roy the Rovers.
Yeah.
And this idea of as a player who has his capacity to do brilliant things at almost any moment. And then what happens is your team, whether it's England, whether it's Liverpool, come to rely on him doing that. And it doesn't matter how badly things are going. Stevie will whack one in from 30 yards as he'd scored against Olympiacos to make it 2-1 in the group stage when they needed to win by two. And then Mella gets the second.
Yeah, Gerrard scored there.
He's got the third.
Your beauty.
But there was this sort of, this belief that Gerrard could just pull it out of the fire when you needed it. And once you come to rely on a player doing that, you sort of forget all the planning and all the organisation that actually goes into top-level football.
In the Champions League in particular, Gerrard was, you would see him and realise just what a good player he was at that level. In Champions League games, against teams that probably weren't so used to playing against a player like him, he would turn up with those great moments and drive his team on.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think he is a very English-type player. I think he is that Roy the Rovers model. But yeah, that idea of
quite unpredictable.
Well, the sort of, who's he like? I guess Pogba now is a little bit like him, maybe a little less committed to one team, maybe a little less good. Brian Robson obviously would have been
Roy Keane, of course.
Roy Keane, yeah.
You know, and Patrick Vieira, obviously, of the foreign players.
With the early Patrick Vieira when he scored goals,
yeah. But Gerrard just had that drive, that zip.
Yeah, or two, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And scoring that goal to get things going.
Well, it's the weirdest thing I've ever known. Like, I can't explain it in retrospect, but he heads it in, makes it 3-1. And I turned to Paddy Barkley, and he turned to me. And I can't remember which of us said it, but we were both thinking it. And said, they've won this now. And I had no... I literally, Control-A-Delete. I deleted everything I've written in the first half, because I had, even at 3-1, I had no doubt Liverpool were winning that game. That's ridiculous. The really strange thing is, I sat next to Paddy at the Bayern-Chelsea game in 2012, that final. And as Thomas Müller walked off the pitch, being substituted with, I don't know, 5 minutes ago or whatever, with the score at 1-0. Yeah, 1-0 to Bayern. And we did the same thing. We turned to each other and went, Chelsea have won this. And I don't know why. I mean,
That was similar to Mateus leaving the field in Barcelona.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, very similar to that. That was the thing that reminded me of,
vainglorious or
whatever. Yeah, the hubris of kind of thinking you've done it. And of course it was, I mean, we don't want to talk too much about 2012, but it was so much more pronounced there because it was in Munich. Yeah. But it is just sort of, suddenly in a stadium, it's like the whole stadium sensed it. The whole stadium knew that something really fundamental has shifted in the momentum of this game. I know maybe it's confirmation bias. Maybe I've had similar feelings in games when it hasn't happened. But, that Gerrard goal changed everything.
Just talking about that goal, a beautiful header by Gerrard, directed it in completely. But Dida's contribution to that.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I have watched that goal before, and I thought, is the keeper, is he a little bit switched off there?
I mean, so you think Dida was switched off for quite a lot of that game.
Well, he certainly switched off for six key minutes in the second half.
Well, to be fair, he did save the penalty.
And pushed it straight back to him. But
but the second goal, the goalkeeper.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a lovely.
Not a howler, but he would have been disappointed.
It's a lovely strike from Smeech here. He was only on the pitch because Keel wasn't there. Yeah, he hits it really well. It's one of those that's slightly difficult for the keeper because it is just bouncing just in front of him, and it has got that little bit of swerve on it.
Keeper's disappointed with himself.
But the keeper's a little bit slow to move across, and it goes over his arm as a result.
That stadium again, that pitch was not the best either.
No.
It seems to sort of catch a little edge off the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, the ball probably had some top spin on it anyway, but yes.
Yeah. But to score 2 minutes after with a goal like that, as you say, it had maybe not everyone had the same conversation you'd had with Paddy Barkley, but when that second goal goes in, suddenly it's kind of like, whoa, hang on.
Well,
where's this come from?
I certainly felt it after the first one, suddenly thought, hang on a minute here. You know, because Liverpool... I'll be honest,
it took the second one for me.
Okay.
I think I'll be forgiven for that.
But you weren't in the stadium.
I wasn't in the stadium.
And I mean, a lot of people I've spoken to since had the same thought of, oh, hang on. This is, Yeah.
So much had gone against Liverpool, and to still have that chance, you thought they would have to grasp it. And obviously,
and also, were you at the Olympiacos game as well? Or?
I was not, no.
Right, because I mean, that was the thing. You know, I sort of thought it's Olympiacos all over again. It's... You know, it kind of. I had the same feeling in that game when it went to 2-1 that they are going to get the goal.
Yeah,
and so you know, there's something this team this season. There's something about them as a. I mean, destiny is a ridiculous word to use,
It feels like it though.
Well, yeah, I think that's the point that a player may not. If you said to a player, "Do you believe in destiny? Do you believe that your life is mapped out?" Right, some may say yes, some, but even those who say no, absolutely not. When they actually play in the game and they get that sniff of this is a bit weird, something odd's happening here, then they start to believe in it. And then it's that as we were saying about the comebacks, what you know, once it becomes believable, it is achievable.
Yeah, and as we said, it was less believable then, but I think these days the comeback is more believable. And maybe that's to do with the change in defending and so on. But
yeah, and I think just there's a cumulative effect. Once they start happening, people start to think they can happen.
But I think also as well that, again, you go back to those starting lineups. When we see Spurs peg back Ajax or Liverpool peg back Barcelona, you know, I don't think there's that much disparity between the sides.
There's no Jimmy Traore.
There's no Jimmy Traore. We should make that absolutely clear. But I do think that Liverpool players, you know, when you're lining up against those Milan players. Now, as we say, a few of them were maybe past their best. Well, that showed they'd been around for a few years. You're looking at Yapstam even, you know, Cafu. You can be a bit intimidated. And when they wipe the floor with you, you can think to yourself, oh, blimey, here we go. But when you get that goal, you think, hang on, they're beatable.
It was an era in which, before that, Liverpool had bought a lot of players and had a huge turnover of players and just had bought a lot of players, but not many good players. And I think that's one of the big differences with Liverpool now is that they buy good players at a considerable premium. And there were so many times that they would buy players like Jimmy Traore, Igor Biscan, you know, gambles that you know,
even
might
Smeech,
have worked.
Who's like a tidy, neat player, but he's not that level.
He had been the best player for, it was Lens they got him from, I think, had been the best player in Ligue 1 that season. So it was one of those where they took a gamble.
They didn't keep him though, did they? Yeah, no. They didn't rate him. That was his last game.
Yeah, before. Exactly. But Liverpool, at that point, it was, and one of the things is that really wasn't Benitez's team. Now, one of the things we do know about Benitez is that he never likes his team and he always wants to change it. But that team he wasn't happy with. I mean, you know, every one of those players, if you spoke to them about with Benitez, would suggest that he wasn't happy with them. Even Gerrard and Carragher in later years have said that.
Well, Xabi Alonso, he wanted to replace with Gareth Barry.
Well... Gareth Barry was a very good Premier League player.
Wasn't
at the time.
Xabi Alonso.
He certainly wasn't. No, but there was just a certain alchemy about this team. One of the players, Luis Garcia, you know, had a great season that season, particularly in Europe. Never really did much beyond that, did he?
Yeah.
And it's just that sort of talismanic
player. Well, he popped up doing some punditry on a recent game, and it took me ages to work out who he was.
Well, quite, yeah.
I'd just totally forgotten about him.
And I think it's a slightly... I think it shows at this point, I mean, Serie A was a stronger league than the Premier League, and that's the big difference that we probably have now. When you look at those lineups, the lineup that Liverpool had is the type that an English team would have, where you'd have a couple of stars, a couple of players making the name with that club, some who would be sold on, and then players to fill in positions and do a job for the manager. Mm. AC Milan looked like the type of all-star team we're used to watching in the Champions League these days, ahead of the time almost.
Mm. Absolutely right. And Xabi Alonso himself got the third goal in that amazing six-minute period. Gerrard breaks through again, trying to grab the game by the scruff of the neck, was fouled.
It was a foul.
He probably was.
It was
a foul.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, very near the edge of the box, shall we say?
Sure. So he goes down, and again, I go back to Jamie Carragher, who said, "Sometimes a football it just goes mad. Emotion takes over, and it's like you're in the park as a 10-year-old kid playing." And he said, "If you look at when Gerrard goes in the box, Carragher said, I think I was nearly up there with him." You know, Carragher's it's kind of like, right, all hands to the pump, and emotion takes over, and that's. Because that is when it's so hard to find focus in the storm. You know, those Milan players are just thinking, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And we see it with teams when they go to Anfield. You know, again, that kind of legend of Liverpool, but not just Liverpool, other teams, but it seems quite prominent with Liverpool in Europe. And when a game suddenly shifts, it's that inevitable feeling. And when Alonso missed the penalty for that moment, you thought, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. That was exactly the problem. And then looking around the press box as it goes in, the only thing that I've known similar to that subsequently was in Belo Horizonte in the semi-final of the World Cup in 2014, when Germany seemed to be able to score. It seemed like it was every 30 seconds. They got five goals in 12 minutes or whatever it was. And people were looking around going, what's going on? I've never seen this before.
It's eerie almost.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Comebacks are more common now. They tend to take longer than 6 minutes.
Yeah, well, that's true. I was going to say, actually, that an assist should be handed to Milan Baros for this. Because if you look at the penalty that Alonso takes, Baros sort of barges into Nesta. So Nesta is the guy running to get the rebound and doesn't get there because of Baros's... So, in the VAR era, that may not have stood.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness it wasn't there.
Well,
for Liverpool
VAR
fans,
era, it might have been 4-0 and Liverpool down 10.
And the interesting thing was, you still got half an hour to play.
Well, and what's really interesting is that my suspicion is if Liverpool had kept going for it, I mean, that's one of the paradoxes of Benitez, that... In some ways, his greatest achievements at Liverpool were when he took the handbrake off, but he was a manager who wanted to play with the handbrake on.
I always think with Rafa, it's where the handbrake was removed from him. Well, the team just went on.
Yeah. So you think of the cup final against West Ham the following season. They needed to be behind and have to throw caution to the wind. But he put the handbrake straight back on. And you sort of think, what would have happened if
he hadn't? Do you think that was wise?
Well, they won, so you can't criticise it.
Sure, but...
I think my memory of the rest of the game is a sort of, more of, balletic Pirlo just making passes, Milan making angles to attack with and Liverpool's last-ditch defending.
And that brilliant save that Duda makes from Shevchenko.
Yeah, which looked... like a reaction save, though. In fact, I was reading, probably written by you, Jonathan. In fact, the goalkeeping coach said it's a technically brilliant save, the one that he made, which is the one where you make a save and then you get up to make the save straight again. You see goalkeepers practice that before every game that you go to. But the memories of that, the almost an hour's football that followed our Milan on the attack. And this is where, Jamie Carragher's legend is writ large from that, where his socks rolled down his ankles, throwing himself in front of everything, Dudek making saves, Liverpool having very few chances, as I recall.
Yeah.
And it was...
But the game almost, it readdressed itself,
It was, became the game of the first half.
But again...
Well, not quite. I mean, it was a game of the first half, but with Liverpool actually defending well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But again... With that inevitability of you thinking, Man, I have to say,
I kind of...
What do you think they would?
I sort of began to think towards the end, Liverpool have actually missed their chance here. What they should have done was finish it off. But, you know, half. I think if it had been 10 minutes to go and when it got back to 3-3, let the thing go because it's massively in your favour.
Yeah.
Maybe to try and sustain that over half an hour.
But do you not think, though, that but it's 3-2 with Liverpool, Milan are still thinking, oh, we're under the cosh defend. And then they get the equaliser. Was once they got the equaliser, Milan are thinking, OK, we've got to go and win this. So if Liverpool are pushed on...
Possibly, but on the other hand, they must be so psychologically shattered that maybe there's a chance to get a fourth or a fifth. But, I mean...
Well, the fact is...
Rafa did what he his... Yeah, all his instincts are. He went back to control.
Yeah.
And thanks to an unbelievable save from Dídek, and I think, you know, Shevchenko still... You know, as magnificently well as Dídek did... to make the first save, get himself back up to make the second. Shevchenko fundamentally has 7 yards of goal to aim at from 3 yards out, and he managed to hit it at the place where it's going to hit Dídek and go over the bar.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, it was clear to me that Liverpool would win.
From that Dídek save from Shevchenko, yeah.
And Gerrard helping out in the defence, and he became Roy the Rovers, but in a defensive role.
He played as a right wing back against Serginho. Though Serginho actually had a lot of the ball. I'm not sure it was the most disciplined.
Well, it was Serginho's cross for the Shevchenko chance.
Yeah.
So we find ourselves at penalties. And really, the way the game went, you thought Liverpool are going to have to win this on penalties if they are going to win the game. But again, when it goes to penalties, you look at the takers and you think, well, surely Milan.
Well, Milan had won the Champions League on penalties 2 years earlier against Juventus at Old Trafford.
But
Shevchenko had scored the winning penalty.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool, they only needed to put away three. Risa was the one who missed. But those who missed for Milan, Serginho, Pirlo and Shevchenko.
Well, Pirlo did what Dudek did is what Joe Hart failed to do.
Seven years later,
when we all knew about Pirlo. So well done, Joe Hart. Shevchenko attempted the same. But and both those penalties betrayed players that had lost their nerve completely.
Well, and it's also, you know...
It's Serginho's.
You have... you know, whenever you get sort of... You know, a fixture comes up and you say something like, you know, Leicester haven't won at Goodison Park for 15 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you sort of think, well... It might matter they haven't won the last 2 years, but realistically, none of these players know. There's Dudek acting out something that happened in 1984. Like that legend of Liverpool, he's literally kind of, he's taken a great moment from 21 years previously and he's reenacted it. And somehow it's had the same psychological impact on another Italian team. And I don't know if Serginho or Shevchenko or Pirlo knew about those Roma misses back in 1984 when Robler did the wobbly legs and... But yeah, Dudek obviously knew, and Dudek sort of reinvoked that.
Surely in Italian football of the 90s and 2000s, keepers trying to put people taking a penalty, I mean, that was, surely they did that because they try every other trick, so.
Yeah, you'd think so, but maybe doing specifically the spaghetti legs, the kind of.
Yeah, it was Jamie Carragher, wasn't it, that encouraged that from Dudek?
Yeah, you know? I've no doubt.
Yeah, that. But I won't use the word that he said. But
Dudek, one of the heroes of the night, it turns out.
And somebody who, like quite a few of the players playing for Liverpool that night, knew that it was certainly his last first game as a first teamer for Liverpool, you know, because we knew that Reina would be coming in. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things about that team as well. I mean, even Steven Gerrard thought that it might be his last game because there was this big Chelsea deal coming into view. It just felt like this was Liverpool's chance. This team, I would imagine, but this team never played again together. Just such a night of, I mean, I know Jonathan doesn't like that word, neither do I, that sort of destiny, really, that
together. I don't dislike the word. I just think it doesn't mean... It's come to mean something different to what it actually means.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's come to mean, in a sporting context... Though, I mean, anybody who's played sport knows it happens. Doesn't matter what your philosophical or religious beliefs are. We've all played sport where you're having a great day and it feels like anything you touch is going to turn to gold. And you've also had the opposite. And, you know, suddenly at half-time, those priorities flipped.
The thing is, Liverpool went through all of it from, like, this has been the worst ever to this being the greatest ever to playing in the greatest ever match. And
I think, you know, while the stadium quite rightly is criticised, the aesthetic of it was perfect.
Well, yeah, that sort of extraterrestrial effects of it, yeah.
And then, yeah, it's kind of quite an old-fashioned look to the stadium inside because there's such a gap behind the goals.
Yeah, the running
track. The black nets. It felt very, very exotic. It felt very foreign. It felt very, you know, it had that sort of sense of exoticism that European adventures had sort of 20, 30, 40 years earlier. And now we've become so familiar with Italian stadiums or Spanish stadiums, they perhaps don't have it. But this felt something very, and the heat of it, the humidity.
Yeah, yeah.
It felt like the European night I remember watching on telly when I was a kid.
Yeah, and that, I just, for me, John, this game, not having seen Liverpool play in the 70s and not really in the sort of early mid 80s and all, this game was such an important game to what Liverpool and especially Jurgen Klopp try and feed into. Now you talk about, you know, the history and the spirit of all this kind of stuff that Liverpool have in their history. But had this game not have happened, I'm not sure that would actually be as pronounced as it is in the modern day.
Yeah, I think something I was going to say is that I felt it's sort of the last game of the old Liverpool. The club was still owned by David Moores and his family. There was a club seeking to modernise. They'd attempted it with Gerard Houllier, who himself, having been a teacher in Liverpool, felt like he was part of the club. Houllier, of course, went and congratulated the players after, which has been a source of controversy. I don't think that's quite as bad as it was made to sound, actually. He's still a Liverpool fan to this day. But Benitez was the manager. Now, this was the point when Liverpool were attempting to modernise. They brought in a leading European coach who'd been very successful in La Liga, won the UEFA Cup. Their other choice, someone that they turned down, someone who has not liked them since and thankfully doesn't hold a grudge, Jose Mourinho. And remember, of course, they'd beaten, on the way, they'd beaten Mourinho's Chelsea, who I would say probably that season were probably the best team in Europe.
I think that's probably fair, yeah. And that game at Anfield, I mean, I was lucky. I think I did certainly every Anfield knockout game that season. So the Juve game was a great game as well.
Fantastic, yeah.
And Igor Bischan's performance in Turin was as outstanding as any individual performance by any Liverpool player at any point in that campaign. He was brilliant in Turin. And again, you know, that capacity to pull a great performance out of a player who probably knew his days at Liverpool were coming to an end.
Yeah, for a manager who is trying to get rid of all these players, but he says he's quite good at getting performances from them.
It occurred to me at the time, but actually the comparison with Chelsea in 2012 is apt in that sense as well, because a lot of those Chelsea players knew they were right at the end, that this was a last chance.
Yeah, and just getting back to that point, I think at that point, Benitez's desire to change the team around meant the club decided that they needed to go in a different direction. That ended up down the, well, near cul-de-sac of the Hicks and Gillette ownership, and then of course the Fenway ownership that they have now. The club needed to modernise. The story is that the day after winning the Champions League for the European Cup for the first time in 21 years, the club shop was closed. Now you compare that to their great rivals, Manchester United, that had a complete merchandising operation, you know, that made them the richest club in the country. Anfield itself was a ground that, until actually quite recently, was not modernised.
Yeah.
Liverpool was still almost like a relic of, and this was almost like the end of the old Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
and it's
taken
a long way to get there.
There was, obviously you don't know, but I sort of suspect that one of the effects of Hillsborough was that there was sort of a circling of the wagons and a kind of look after our own.
Yeah.
And so when suddenly you get these new economic opportunities from with Sky and the birth of the Premier League, which Manchester United seized incredibly enthusiastically and incredibly efficiently, and Liverpool there was no mentality at the club to do anything radical, to shake anything up. They were still sort of trying to come to terms of what had happened. And
also they'd been successful by doing it their own homespun way. Yeah. And that was always, from what I understand, David Moores' attitude to it and those that are around him. And at this game, there were fans from all over the world. Liverpool had a worldwide reputation in it from an era when, okay, some of the games were shown around the world, but not in the blanket coverage we get now. And I suppose it re-announced Liverpool.
Absolutely. And a Champions League final is the perfect place to do that, especially in such circumstances. And since then, three Champions League finals that they've reached. And Liverpool are now this global force and whatnot. And that night in Istanbul, one of the most important and one of the most celebrated in their illustrious history. I think we can all agree.
Yeah.
Well, that finally we're at the end of that. We could have talked probably another half an hour there, gentlemen. What a game it was indeed. John, thank you very much.
Delighted to be here. Thanks,
a fine choice. We've all thoroughly enjoyed that, unless, of course, you're an Evertonian or a Milan fan. And you've probably switched off ages ago. But there we are. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the Blizzard's Greatest Games podcast, recorded at Outset Studios in South Wimbledon. Jonathan and I will be back for more games from the history of football.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.